Hey, it's NPR's Book of the Day. I'm Andrew Limbong. All right, I think it's clear at this point that if we're going to deal with climate change, we've got to think bigger than canvas tote bags and composting. In his new book, Climate Capitalism, Bloomberg News reporter Akshat Rathi argues that capitalistic market forces can push forward some of these bigger picture solutions to deal with climate change. But the market can't do it alone. In this interview with Here and Now Scott Tong, Rathi talks about one instance in which he and his family tried to get solar panels installed in his home in India. But there was an issue that is kind of indicative of why climate change is so hard to tackle in the first place. That's ahead.
This message comes from NPR sponsor HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel. On The Sympathizer podcast, host Philip Nguyen joins the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen to discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
It is now cheaper to save the world than destroy it. That is a slogan, a rallying cry that animates entrepreneurs and investors who think capitalism can help solve the climate crisis. Now, time out, you might say. Some of the richest companies built their fortunes on mining coal, pumping fossil fuels to burn in cars and make electricity. So what gives? What is this question of climate capitalism? Well, let's put that question to our next guest. Akshat Rathi is a senior climate reporter for Bloomberg News, and he's got a new book out. It's called Climate Capitalism, Winning the Race to Zero Emissions and Solving the Crisis of Our Age. Akshat Rathi, welcome to Here and Now.
Hey, nice to be here.
So I want to get to this skeptic's question first, that a lot of climate activists, and let's be honest, a lot of our listeners in public radio might say, climate capitalism is an oxymoron. That the market system, as the argument might go, exploits nature, it pollutes, it is the problem. Perhaps we need less capitalism. How do you respond to that?
Well, the skeptics are right that the capitalism that exists does make the problem worse. But the book tries to make the case that actually, if you modify capitalism, there is a way to make the system to harness the forces it has for doing good rather than making this problem worse. And frankly, even before we get to what those tweaks could be, if you speak to perhaps the most famous anti-capitalist, Noam Chomsky, even he will tell you that within the time that we have to hit zero emissions, there is just not enough time to come up with a new system to replace capitalism. Much better to modify what we have.
Yeah. You know, kind of on this question, you write in your book that the root of the climate crisis is not capitalism, but the corruption of capitalism. How so?
Very much so. One of the things that capitalism is focused on is being able to make profits. Oftentimes, in the past century, it has been done without any understanding of the costs that society pays for those profits. And what has changed since the Paris Agreement in 2015 and onwards is that governments have now recognized that we cannot continue to ignore the costs. But also, businesses understand this because now climate impacts are hitting their own bottom line. So what climate capitalism argues for is that more than ever before, governments will need to provide direction for the economy. And that might feel like a socialistic idea. Mm-hmm. But in fact, what governments have done even in the past is used their power to create markets, but direct those markets in a particular area because that's the service that society wants.
I want to ask about kind of the role of government. You know, markets all around the world face some level of regulation, and you're talking about, you know, the hand of government to perhaps give a signal to this engine of capitalism. And you profile a number of people in your book, and one of them is a government official in China. His name is Wang Gong, and you write that he did more to make electric cars a reality than Elon Musk. Tell us quickly his story.
So we think of China as a dictatorship, which it is politically. And of course, it's led by the Communist Party. But China is anything but socialist or communist. It is a state-driven capitalistic economy. Now, Wang Gang is a fascinating character. He was born in China, studied auto engineering, went to Germany, rose up the ranks of Audi. And then he looked back at his own country and thought, well, if my people are to live the kind of lifestyle that Germans do, they'll have to burn 16 times as much oil per person. And there's just not enough of that in the world available. And of course, now we think of China as the world's largest maker of electric cars and the largest maker of lithium-ion batteries that power those electric cars. And it could not have happened without Wangang making that case. And of course, then the Chinese state providing incentives and market direction for a lot more private money, hundreds of billions of dollars of private money coming in to make this transition.
Yeah, yeah. No, interesting. I was based in China for several years. The last time I went was 2019, and I went to the city where this EV company BYD is based in Shenzhen in southern China. You went there too as part of your reporting. And I first of all, right, every cab there, you know, by government, provincial government decree, is an electric vehicle from this company BYD. I found interesting that the cab drivers there, you know, they complained about the brakes on the BYD cars because they said they wore out quickly because perhaps the electric cars were heavier and, you know, the car makers were still trying to tweak it so that it went the best. But that's one example of an individual. I want to ask about a couple other individuals you profile in your book. One of them is not an entrepreneur, not a government official, not an investor, but a lawyer and climate activist, Farhana Yamin. Tell us about her.
So Farhana Yamin was and still is a lawyer, and she was actually quite crucial in the work done to get the Paris Agreement across, one of the sort of six or seven women architects who were very important. However, she's not been happy with the pace at which governments are responding and acting on the commitments that they've made. The moment I feature her in the book is when she's given up hope that the system is not going to be changed and that people have to take it in their hands to change the system. And she goes and glues herself to the headquarters of the Shell building in London, and she gets arrested. So this is not the only way, but what I am showing in the book is throughout the world, there are places where you can make it work. And when it doesn't work, activism certainly has a role.
Yeah, we are talking to Akshat Rathi. His book is Climate Capitalism. And Akshat, a little bit of this book is personal. You write about your own family, your parents in India who put solar panels on top of their house. What did you learn about the market incentives in that part of the world that could be tweaked or pushed in the green direction?
So I grew up in India, and India is still a developing country, has, you know, about $2,000 per capita income. But what happens in India is when a technology solution or a product is economical and it's better than the alternative that existed, Indians adopt that really very quickly. And so that's the moment in 2019 when I worked with my father to try and get solar panels installed on our roof in India. It was very easy to find people who were willing to sell good solar panels, people who were willing to put it up on the roof. The difficulty was trying to then connect that to the grid and get the permission to actually use those solar panels at home.
Oh.
And so climate capitalism is about making sure it's not just that the markets are working, but that government and government institutions are in sync with market reality.
Yeah. You know, I guess the question is, how fast can this happen? Because, and you go into this in your book, these energy transitions tend to take a long time. When the world went from burning wood to coal, took generations. Going from coal to oil and gas took generations. And now we're talking about this new green energy transition by 2050. You know, even with the engine of markets, is that realistic?
Well, there is certainly a plan for it. And that plan has been backed by 195 governments and has been backed by thousands of scientists. So in the technical feasibility of whether we can get to zero emissions, there is very little doubt that, yes, it's possible. The biggest difficulty that is faced is the political reality of just the sheer amount of changes that will need to be made, the number of lives of different people that will be affected, either positively or negatively, because they'll have to do a different job or they might even have to move to a different place. And that is the hardest part of the transition. And so in the book, I try and chart what are the three factors that are needed. It's technology, policy, but most importantly, people. There are places all around the world in all sectors of the economy, whether that's electric cars, whether that's green cement, whether that's regenerative agriculture. The solutions are there. It's for people to realize how to grasp it and how to take advantage of them and how to find the opportunities in this transition.
We've been talking about the book Climate Capitalism, Winning the Race to Zero Emissions and Solving the Crisis of Our Age. The author is Akshat Rathi. He's also a senior climate reporter for Bloomberg News. Akshat, so good to have you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
All that sitting and swiping, your body is adapting to your technology. Learn how and what you can do about it.
I really felt like the cloud in my brain kind of dissipated. Once I started realizing what a difference these little breaks were making, there's no turning back for me.
Take NPR's Body Electric Challenge. Listen to the series wherever you get your podcasts.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. OCI is the platform for database, application development, and AI needs. Do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic. Take a free test drive at oracle.com/NPR.